Friday was obviously an incredibly exciting day for everyone. You know, in the three marriage cases that GLAAD has now litigated, there's always tons of rumors that come out before the decision is issued. You know, in the Goodrich case, there was a rumor that Justice Marshall was seen leaving Martha's Vineyard, which sparked all kinds of intense speculation about whether that meant that Goodrich was coming out. And we've been waiting 17 months for this decision, which was quite a long time, and there have been rumors along the way. But last Thursday, there was a rumor that somebody in the governor's office was saying the decision was coming out. And so that put us into a little bit more of a heightened sense of anticipation. Ordinarily, we expected to get an email the day before telling us the decision was coming out, so that we were waiting anxiously for that email. And when the email didn't come, I thought, you know, just another rumor among many. But we knew from our local counsel that sometimes in high-profile cases, the court will deviate from its usual procedure. So Friday morning, we indeed did get the phone call from the reporter of decisions, and we condensed our planning a little bit, I would say, and got in a car, rushed down to Hartford, and just as we were pulling into the Hilton where we were going to have our press conference, my cell phone rang, and it was our local counsel, Ken Barchi, who just said two words, "We won." And fortunately, I was not driving. I just want to, before I talk about the decision, just thank our local counsel, our Connecticut lawyers, who just did such tremendous work on this case. Ken Barchi and Karen Dowd at Horton Shelton Knox, Maureen Murphy of Murphy, Murphy & Nugent, and the ACLU of Connecticut. And I want to give a special thanks to our plaintiffs in this case. We, you know, in all of these cases, these couples are really the community's representatives before the Supreme Court, and we just had phenomenal plaintiffs in this case. And two of them are on the call with us, Janet Peck and Carol Conklin, and they'll be saying a few words shortly. But thank you, Janet and Carol. You were just fabulous throughout the whole thing. Looking at the decision, it was quite a long decision, as these cases can be, and the court based its decision on the Equal Protection Clause of the Connecticut Constitution, concluding that the denial of marriage to same-sex couples could not satisfy the requirements of equal protection. And it was a 4-3 decision, with Justice Palmer writing the opinion, joined by Katz, Northcott, and Lubby Harper, who was a appellate court judge. The court started by rejecting the trial court's conclusion that there was no constitutional analysis even required in our case, because, as the trial court concluded, there was no difference between marriage and a civil union. That was really all the trial court did, is to say that civil union and marriage are the same thing, end of story. And here, at the outset, the court swatted that away and, in very strong language, noted that in light of the history of discrimination against lesbian and gay people, civil unions have relegated same-sex couples to an inferior status, and that civil unions declare same-sex couples to be unworthy of the institution of marriage, and they send a message that what same-sex couples have is not as important or significant as real marriage. That was really just a preliminary point, but it is notable for the fact that it was actually the only point upon which all seven justices agreed. All seven justices at least agreed that the trial court got that wrong. In terms of the court looking at the Equal Protection Clause and the kind of analysis it did, it found that laws that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation have to be subjected to a closer or stricter review than just ordinary legislation. And so that means that Connecticut now joins California as the only two high courts in the country finding that sexual orientation classifications must be more rigorously scrutinized. Now, the significance of that is for what kind of justifications can actually survive sexual orientation-based classifications in the law. And just a quick overview about what these sort of levels of scrutiny really mean. Most laws that are passed by a legislature, whether they're tax laws or benefits programs, only have to be rational. They only have to be rationally related to some legitimate state interest. And this is a very deferential standard. It's based on the principle that legislatures draw distinctions and classifications. That's the legislative prerogative, and the courts are not going to interfere unless those laws are irrational. But then there are some kinds of classifications which courts, for example, in race or national origin, where courts have noted that because there's been a history of discrimination, that distinctions that a law may make based upon particular traits are very likely to be motivated by prejudice or antipathy against that group, rather than on some kind of legitimate difference between members of that class and others. And so race-based distinctions, for example, get what we call strict scrutiny, which means those classifications have to be justified by a compelling state interest. And then there's this mid-level area, which some courts have looked at, intermediate scrutiny, or what is sometimes called quasi-suspect class distinctions. And that's what the Connecticut court did here. It said that in those laws can only be justified if there's a substantial relationship to an important governmental objective. So you can see, looking at those standards, heightened scrutiny is really important because it presumes there's something improper about legislating based on sexual orientation and requires the state to do more than just give a very simple reason such as tradition to uphold laws like the marriage laws that exclude same-sex couples. So that's really the significance of this decision. And the court noted that there are two factors in looking at whether a group of people is deserving of heightened scrutiny that are really the keys. And they were the factors that the dissent also agreed with, and that was a history of purposeful discrimination. And the court went through quite a detailed history of the kinds of hatred and discrimination and stigma that lesbian gay people in this country and have faced. And the second factor is that the trait has no relationship to the ability to perform in society. And the court, again, went through why it's now well established that sexual orientation has nothing to do with anything that's relevant in terms of parenting, ability to be a citizen, and so forth. It was really the third and fourth factors that got a little bit more of the discussion. And those factors are what are sometimes labeled as immutability and political powerlessness. The court started by noting that those are really subsidiary factors, that they may be relevant, but the first two are really the key. And then looking at the immutability factor, that's an area that has obviously sometimes created problems in litigation because some courts have understood that to mean, is there a biological origin to homosexuality, or can sexual orientation be changed at all? And I think what was so heartening about this decision, like the California decision, was that that's not how the court looked at the immutability factor. The court understood it to mean something that, rather than looking at can it be changed, looked at it as a characteristic or a trait that is so fundamental to personal identity and self-determination. And the court said that although we do not doubt that sexual orientation is highly resistant to change, we don't need to decide that sexual orientation is immutable in the same way that race, national origin, or gender are immutable. The court went on to say that sexual orientation is so central to a person's core identity that it would be abhorrent for government to penalize a person for refusing to change it. So that is important, obviously not only because it gets beyond some of the difficult immutability questions of the past, but this is really sending a signal to other courts about the humanity of lesbian gay people and the importance of protecting people who are discriminated against on the basis of this personal characteristic. The real battle lines between the majority and the dissent came in this notion of political powerlessness, that you only get some form of heightened scrutiny if you're a group that lacks political power. That, again, has been an area where there hasn't been a whole lot of guidance until very recently in these marriage cases about what this really means, because clearly race, the African Americans have gained significant progress in the political arena. Women who get quasi-suspect class, intermediate scrutiny under federal law, also have really gained in political power. So what does this really mean, that you have to be politically powerless? And what the court said, and I think this was really probably the best decision I've read, really laying out what political powerlessness means. The court said you can't take that too literally, and it's not that political powerlessness is really a misnomer, and that what it means is that in spite of progress, the discrimination is unlikely to be eliminated solely by the legislative process. Now, Justice Borden, who was sort of a swing vote, and we didn't know how he was going to come out, he wrote a dissent in this case. He was one of the dissenting justices, and he disagreed with the majority's view of political power. And in fact, he said, in what I thought was actually really going beyond what could be concluded in the case, he said that, in fact, gays and lesbians have extraordinary and unique political power. And what he focused that on was really remarkable in and of itself, because he focused it on certainly the passage of anti-discrimination legislation in Connecticut, but he placed a tremendous amount of emphasis on the fact that a press conference was held in 2007 at which the supporters of marriage legislation said that they thought a bill would pass soon. And that was really the sort of core of why he thought that in spite of the history of discrimination, in spite of the fact that sexual orientation has nothing to do with a person's ability to perform, in spite of the fact that it's a core aspect of personal identity, that this defeated quasi-suspect classification for sexual orientation. And Justice Palmer, I think, wrote an incredibly strong and detailed refutation of that. And what he did as the sort of focus of his of rebutting Borden's claim was to really make an analogy between the political power of women in 1973, the year the U.S. Supreme Court determined the classifications based on sex were suspect, and to use that case to demonstrate what political power really means. So he said, for example, that the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973 noted that women had made significant political advances. I mean, there was a federal law prohibiting sex discrimination in employment and public accommodations in 1973, the Civil Rights Act of 64. And in fact, Congress had just adopted the ERA and sent it out to the states for ratification. So that clearly means that you can have some political clout and still attain quasi-suspect class status. And, you know, Palmer noted in contrast, I mean, lesbian and gay people are a very small portion of the population. There are nobody elected statewide office in Connecticut was lesbian or gay, small number of legislators, no Supreme Court or appellate court judges, just as Palmer pointed out, one trial court judge in the whole state. So he made those kinds of contrasts. But then I thought he did some really interesting things, too, which I think will help in other states. He actually looked at the language of the anti-discrimination laws that Justice Borden pointed to as being evidence of political power. And he pointed out the language in the gay rights law, which, is frankly all too common in some of these statutes, that says the state does not condone homosexuality or bisexuality or any equivalent lifestyle, and that this legislation does not authorize promotion of homosexuality in educational institutions. And he noted that these reservations and disclaimers do not appear for any other protected class in the anti-discrimination laws, and that, in fact, if you look at that language, it's really a proclamation from the state that same-sex relationships are disfavored, and that kind of language serves to undermine the legitimacy of same-sex relationships and perpetuates feelings of inferiority and inadequacy. He also used the Equal Rights Amendment, which Congress had had passed and sent out of the states, kind of challenged Justice Borden on the fact that some legislators had said there's optimism about passing a marriage bill. And at the time the ERA was moved out of Congress, there was tremendous optimism, and a lot of people were saying that this was going to be easily ratified by the states, and that was certainly a far greater significance than a press conference at which people typically inflate the likelihood of success anyways. So after finding that sexual orientation was subject to heightened scrutiny, he actually spent very little time, Justice Bomber did, on the state's justifications. And the state's justifications were incredibly weak. Their two justifications for excluding couples from marriage were uniformity of Connecticut's laws with the laws of other states, that since most other states don't have marriage, Connecticut has an interest in having its laws be like other states, and the notion of maintaining the traditional definition of marriage as between a man and a woman. And he really only gave about a paragraph or two after going 85 pages, a paragraph or two on why these justifications really were wholly inadequate to meet this intermediate scrutiny level of review. So it was a really strong opinion and one that I think will, hopefully, along with California, really give other states and other courts a roadmap about how to find sexual orientation as a suspect classification. So just a couple things I want to touch on just in terms of follow-up and next steps that people have been wondering about. And one is, of course, what everybody was asking on Friday, which is when can we get married? And the answer is that it should be, the earliest date would be November 7th. It could be a little later than that. The way it works in terms of just making this decision final is that it's all tied to the official release date, which is October 28th. And then from that official release date, you have to wait 10 days for the time for motions for reconsideration to actually pass. And then the trial court can actually enter the official judgment. Sometimes it happens same day. Other times it happens, a few days later. And we're going to be working with the Superior Court in New Haven to kind of nail that down. The other thing people are asking is what happens to the civil unions law, because this case, it was not a constitutional challenge to the civil union law. It was a case for marriage. And so there's no question in our minds that if somebody is currently in a civil union, they can still get married, because a civil union is not a marriage. But the legislature will probably at some point take up cleaning up the civil unions law. It's unclear, and they haven't made any indications of what they will do, but probably setting some kind of system to transition from a situation where we have two statuses to one in which there's one status of marriage, and also getting rid of the language that exists in the Connecticut statutes right now that marriage is between a man and a woman. That is of no effect today, but it's something that should be repealed. So that's a couple things to look for down the road. And we'd also like to ask Janet and Carol, who have been such terrific plaintiffs, to say just a few words about what Friday was like and what this means for them.
Unbelievable.
Carol is one of few words, and that kind of sums it up, though, doesn't it? Unbelievable. We're just thrilled. Actually, the weekend, I think we were just walking around in a fog. We alternated between crying and just smiling. Our smile muscles ache. We smiled so much, and we're just thrilled, and we're so grateful to GLAAD, to everybody at GLAAD, to the lawyers, to all the staff, to the local co-counsel. I mean, we're just thrilled. I mean, we're excitingly already trying to pin down a date for our wedding, and of course, it hasn't been pinned down when we can actually get married yet. But it was an unbelievable day, and we're still getting phone calls and emails from people congratulating us. So it's been terrific.